Hello, hello. So, welcome to the Shropshire Witches. How are we going to describe this, Amy? Is this our extra content? Is this our bonus content? What are we going to say for this?
Should we say it's that extra content, a little bit of extra content for you?
Agreed, agreed, agreed. So, when we discussed this, we were kind of putting ideas about what we wanted to talk about and things like that. And then we sort of discussed the idea of maybe putting a story to one another that the other didn't know. Or know much about, and I think that's I know that that's what we're going to do tonight. So I'm going to pass to you, Amy, because this is where you're going to take the wheel, and you're going to tell me and the rest of us a story.
Yes, so we are going to go to Wenlock Edge tonight. We're going to spend some time at Wenlock Edge, and we're going to very much keep on theme with the podcast because we're going to be looking at a story of witchcraft. And it's a story that has, ever since I have been researching it, has left an incredible mark on me, I feel, and something that I actually I feel very, very strongly about the story, the case, and sharing the truth behind her. So we'll go straight into it. And it is about Anne Morgan, who some of you may know as Nanny Morgan. So when I was first introduced to the idea of Nanny Morgan, I was told about this wicked, evil witch that was so wicked and evil and seduced people and did all these awful wicked witch things that when she died, she became a ghost. And her ghost is said to haunt various areas of Wenlock Edge, most commonly near Westwood Common, which isn't actually, there's not actually much there anymore. I think there's still the remains of the quarry, but there's not too much there. And she was meant to stand on Westwood Common and try and kind of get people to come near to her. And if you're a young man, she said to seduce you. And if you cast eyes on this spirit, she's meant to make you fall helplessly, helplessly in love with her. And you'll never, ever, ever love another. Your soul is hers. So naturally, I was a little bit intrigued because, you know, you've got this witch that even after death is capable of, you know, seducing men to the point where they can't, they're like dogs kind of thing. But when I started to research her and to look at her actual story, it's so much deeper than that. And it's actually a really quite a tragic true crime situation that, and you have, I'm always incredibly part fond of the folklore stories that are part folklore, part history. And the story of Anne Morgan really fits within that sphere. So I think that she is someone who has been incredibly misunderstood in life, but also incredibly misunderstood for over a century afterwards. And frustratingly, when you look at some fairly contemporary folklore accounts, kind of from the 60s, 70s, she's still being portrayed as the ghost story I was familiar with, this wicked, evil spirit that seduces young men. So I think we'll start off by, to begin at the beginning, as we say, and talk about who she was. Now, we don't really know too much about her early life. We know that she grew up around Westwood Common, that her father was most probably a quarryman. And I have managed to track down some records for her date of birth to be sometime in 1796, so a little bit earlier than what the some other folklorists suggest. And she was baptized in 17 that kind of time. And we know that she was 66 at the time of her death. So we have a kind of timeline. She was 1796, she was born, and she dies in 1857. Now, she was the daughter of Richard and Martha Williams, and they were actually married in 1779 in a place called Harley Village, which is again near Wenlock Edge. Now, the family house was known as, according to the folklore, Five Chimneys, but it's actually the area. So folklorists have got a bit confused in the past. So the area, the part of Westwood Common, was called the Five Chimneys area. And it was a row of 13 cottages built for the limestone workers around 1800. Okay. There was an idea in some of the accounts I've seen that she lived in a house with five chimneys that showed her wealth. She didn't. She lived in a limestone cottage.
Interesting. And
the limestone industry is incredibly kind of prevalent in that area. We don't know actually too much about who she was when she was younger. We have a record that suggests that she was tall, dark-haired, with steely eyes and a stern countenance. So she's already, even in girlhood, being stereotyped as a witch.
Yeah.
She's got a very stern, kind of negative countenance. And I don't really know how accurate that is. I don't know whether that's accurate or whether it's something that has been put forward in order to try and make her seem atypical to her peers. But this really, I feel like I'm rushing through it, but her story begins in 1809. So in 1809, she was implicated in a robbery whilst working in Boughton alongside a girl called Mary Beamond. As a bit of an aside, interestingly, Mary Beamond's mum was the last person to do penance for adultery in Much Wenlock. So we're getting a theme of women who are not acceptable by society already. Yeah. And the two girls were working as servants in the house. They stole some clothes and some goods from the house, and they were found having the items in their possession. Anne, we don't know whether Anne was the instigator, but she certainly had more items in her possession. So she got into quite a bit of trouble and ended up being put on trial in the 29th of March, 1809. And she was sentenced. Now, we don't actually know how long she was in prison, but she was put in prison. And we don't have much about her actual time in prison, which is quite normal for the period and for who, you know, the kind of socioeconomic situation she was in. But we do know that when she came out, she was in an awful predicament, because her family completely did not want anything to do with her. They completely ostracized her. And she was very unlikely to find a husband based on her predicament. We do know she did have a husband a little bit later on. But she found herself in a position where no one was willing to give her a chance. And she was still fairly young when she came out of prison. She'd have only just kind of late teens, very early 20s. So this really is a very tragic situation because her family don't want her, the local community don't want her, and the only thing she can really see in her future is potentially the workhouse, which, as we both know and listeners know, is not what anybody wants to find themselves in. But this is really the event, I think, that changed the trajectory of Anne Morgan's life for an incredibly positive way, but also I think probably was the stepping stones to for her to end up where the situation she was actually in. And that was when she met the local travelling community. So as with many areas in Shropshire, the kind of Irish traveller community used to come to Wenlock Edge, and they would set up camps and they would go and work as itinerant workers around the farms, either in Wenlock and around Wenlock Edge, but also further afield like Madeley and kind of my neck of the woods. So she was in her most kind of vulnerable of positions, and she met the traveling community and they completely embraced her. They allowed her to join them. They allowed her to kind of have a sense of herself again, I believe, after prison. And they really did not judge her. And I think this is probably, obviously I can't speak for her, but I think these were probably the first people to to have not judged her since she had her predicament. So she found in a group that was already relatively ostracized a sense of herself and a sense of community, which I think is incredibly important. And within that community, she was said to have actually had quite a bit of fun, shall we say. She was one person in Much Wenlock says that she took to unchristian practices. So one can only imagine what sort of thing they got up to. I don't know whether you want to have a guess or whether anyone at home wants to have a guess. So
I'm sure there's a few ideas. Although sometimes Christian didn't always leave a wide parameter, did it?
No, it didn't. Sometimes unchristian could be, you know, I don't know, not wearing the right shade of black or wearing two different types of material or something.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
So
she's let's hope having... it was something exciting. I bet it was.
So she's having a really good time with the traveling community, and they actually teach her how to read cards, read fortunes, and she picks up all these kind of parlor trick type divination stuff. So not you like your kind of curses and hexes or anything like that. But you kind of, I'm going to read your future, I'm going to read your tea leaves, I'm going to still, you know, very powerful practices in their own right. But she would have seen them primarily, I believe, as a source of income. And you do see a number of witches in Shropshire, I believe we touched on it in the first episode, who kind of use their craft as a way to support themselves economically. So old Dolly of Edgemond, she benefited. She was the one that wore the nice short skirts and the big hats.
Just love it. Legend. Just such a good name.
Well, legend. Queen. And old Dolly benefited financially from being known as a witch because she could kind of pull the leg and say, oh, well, I'll curse you if you don't give me a tenner, but obviously not a tenner. you know, she could use it as a, and I believe that's what Anne did. I believe that the fortune telling and the kind of card reading and the palm reading, that kind of thing, gave her a sense of income, a sense of financial independence that in many ways was quite unique to a Victorian woman, because she wasn't married, particularly in the early years when she was on the road with the traveling community. She didn't have any real, you know, burdens with children or anything like that. So she was able to be quite financially independent because she was actually quite good at it. And she got a kind of reputation for her accuracy as well, which was really quite good. But we actually, after a little bit of time with the traveling community, we lose her trail a little bit.
Yeah.
She's transient. She's enjoying herself, probably immensely, being very unchristian. And she leaves Westwood Common. She leaves Much Wenlock. We probably leave Shropshire, and we can only kind of guess and imagine where our girl ends up for a bit. And then we catch back up with her with a reference to her having married a young man called Thomas Morgan. Mm-hmm. And that was from the 1841 census. So she's back in Much Wenlock in the 1841 census at Westwood Common.
Okay.
Now, a lot of my work with Anne has been kind of interweaving the history and the folklore and working out which one is folklore that is very linked to history and has some historical basis, folklore that is completely fantastical and that has been made up, or folklore that enhances the story a little bit. So we're told that one morning on market day, people are going to market and Anne Morgan just swans right back into Much Wenlock, kind of like when someone returns to the Queen Vic and EastEnders. Get out of my pub, get out of my market.
I love that. Why not?
And she tells people that she's returning to the area because her father's died, so she's taking on his house. So she's returns to the area. She marries Thomas Morgan, who was an agricultural labourer. We know that from the sources. And they're married, they're living in Westwood Common, and she is continuing. Let's learn.
You said it was conviction, so it felt like it was. Yeah.
She is continuing to peddle her trade. So she is selling fortunes, she's selling curses, she's doing love potions. She's really is using her return to Shropshire to expand her business. And business is booming. It's absolutely booming. She makes an incredible amount of money in the process, and she ends up going from someone who is very marginalized because she's a woman, she's a working class woman, and she's a working class woman who's been to prison, to being a relatively a relatively wealthy person. So she sells curses, she tells people that she can read their fortune, she can tell people what their husband's up to, probably because she's kept an eye on and she's witnessed it or something. And we are told that women of all social standings, from the lowliest servant to the most wealthy and prestigious kind of country lady, actually uses Anne Morgan for her services. And she is known to be an incredibly successful witch, what we would now call.
Yeah.
And I think this is where we start to see a real kind of change in how she's seen in some regards, but also she's still being ostracized by the community. So she is seen as being incredibly talented as a soothsayer, and her foresight and skills make her commodity for many people who would go to her for like love potions or fortune telling or that kind of thing. But she was still ostracized. She was still met with indignation and in some cases even fear. So we start to get a number of kind of oral tradition stories and folklore about how she's got the evil eye and you avoid her at all costs. And, you know, if you were going to do anything, you make sure that you stay away from Anne Morgan because she can curse you.
Mm.
But my question has always been, if she was that terrible, why are they still going to see her? And I think we touched on this a lot in the first episode of how you've got this real juxtaposition with women's places when they're in these marginalized kind of areas, like even things like midwives in the past and witches in the past, is that they were marginalized, they were ostracized, they were met with indignation and fear, but actually people still went to see them, people still used their services, and people actually really needed them, even if it was for just a peace of mind or for, you know, support. And we do have some really quite brilliant stories of Anne kind of sticking one to the man kind of thing. So there's a folk story about how she used to keep an eye on the quarrymen to make sure the quarrymen weren't overworking their animals. And so the one day there was this rather kind of grumpy, gruff quarryman, and he'd absolutely overstacked his horse. And she said to him, no, you've got too much on that animal. It's going to work it to death. And he said, I'll put as much as I bloody want on it, kind of thing. As you did. Yeah, absolute prick.
Little prick points right there, like, bit. Sorry, carry on, but prick. Yeah.
Yeah. So she tells him again and he ignores it. And we're told that she grabs a piece of straw and puts it on the animal, and the animal dies because it's the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah.
And even though that animal had to suffer, she was able to prove to him that she was right, she was powerful, and he was wrong. And it said that this quarryman did everything he could to avoid going past her house after that, because he knew her power, but also he never ever overstacked his horse again. He never made them do too
much. I was going to say, fine, you know, if you have to avoid her, but how did he treat his animals? But yeah, I'm glad that you said that. He learned a lesson. Good.
And
good.
It's interesting because this folk story is found in several areas in the country. And it's always linked to a woman who is seen as a witch, who is ostracized from the community. And it's always found whenever there is a pocket of industry. So there's an evidence of it being in Yorkshire, for instance, where there's a lot of mining. And so it's not unique to Nanny Morgan, but what it is a story that someone has attributed to her, which is quite cool.
Yeah.
And I think that she symbolizes in this part of her life when she is, you know, being used by the community, but being ostracized by the community, so many women in these rural spheres or further afield, where they're being used and abused, really. And I think she also symbolizes a way that a woman navigates the difficulty of poverty and the difficulty of life in these industrialized areas. And I think that's what's very powerful about her story. Even though we don't know for certain some of the details, I think her story is powerful as a symbol as well as it is as a historical entity in quite a number of ways. We also see her kind of starting to really enjoy the stereotype, I think, a little bit. So she...
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, so she goes from kind of maybe finding it a little bit awkward or difficult to when she starts becoming quite wealthy, getting quite eccentric with it. So that's around the time that she has a whole swarm of cats. It's always referred to as a swarm. So I don't know exactly... yeah, well, is five a swarm?
yeah, not quite, is it?
No,
but not quite.
Yeah, get you close. A few more and then you can be on the right track.
Yeah, definitely.
So she's got a swarm of cats. She's got dogs as well. She's a great dog lover. Some of her cats have got quite funny names, we're told. So she's got amongst some of them, she had a few that were, again, with the folklorists and being slightly too uppity. She had a few that had such vile names, you can't repeat them. So probably like Bastard or something like that. I don't know.
I love that you chose that. Probably Bastard.
Yeah, why not? But she's definitely recorded as having Hellblow and Satan's Smile. The thing I love about that is that, you know, if you told someone, a pious, God-fearing person, that there was a lady who lived down the road with a cat called Satan's Smile, they'd be ready to, you know, wicker man her.
They'd be all like lynch mob coming up, like they'd be coming from chapel, like, I know where we're going.
Yeah, we're going down there. But you can tell that's something that she has done as a laugh. Oh, yeah, my cat's called Satan's Smile. You know, it's her having fun with it, I think.
Shock factor, which I love. I love her for that, because she's like, do you know what? Fine, let's just play the game, because it's funny. It's tongue-in-cheek. Yeah, she's cool. I like her.
And it's very much, it's like, well, you think I'm a monster? I'll show you a monster.
It's Satan's Smile.
Yeah. And this is the time as well that she's got that whole box of toads, which I know we definitely mentioned, she feeds on communion bread. And she showers with kisses, which is lovely.
Yeah, but that, like, anyone who's an animal lover, you're like, girl, like, yeah, you are. She's a queen. Like, if you're nice to animals, that's it. Like, yeah.
And she was an absolute animal lover. She's got her frogs, toads, she's got her dogs, her cats. Her house would have been amazing. I would love to have visited. And she is noted in the records, the records we do have of her involvement with animals, which is not very many, that she is an animal lover and she treats them with great care. Mm. And again, it's kind of almost a bit, people don't say it like, oh, she treats her animals with love. It's like, oh, she treats her animals with love. What kind of thing?
That equates to the people that are like, is your dog allowed on the sofa? And I'm like, babe. Serge sleeps on the pillow. Like, do you know what I mean? His head on a pillow. It does make you jump, but in the morning you turn around, you're like, oh, Serge. But like, yes, my dog is allowed on the sofa. Yeah, it's always, people go, it's just a dog. And you're like,
it's not, no. Serge is up about 173, though, so he's allowed to do what he wants.
We met her, to be fair, but yeah. He's old.
Maybe, he was one of her pets. We don't know.
Do you know what? Let's just say that he was, because I love that. Like, that makes him more of a mascot. Love it. It's not tenuous.
And there was one thing that when I was looking at initially researching, is that she is absolutely condemned more than anything for having a whole library of books.
Educated, yeah, tricky.
She has a library of books, and they say that they have to be occult tomes. There's no other way they could be anything else. They have to be the wickedest possible books, because why else would a woman read? The only reason a woman would read is to be wicked and to curse men. It's got to be. So there is some, there's some suggestion that she might have had something along the lines of maybe one book that gave her something like that. But we don't have any proof, because as we'll find out, her, a lot of her items were destroyed after she was actually met her end. But I think her reading, her care of animals, her background, her persistence as well, I think that is the mark of her otherness. She didn't have the best start, she didn't have the best situation, but she did the best she could with it. She, you know, run away with a traveling community, and she found acceptance with them, and all of what she had in her life marked her as other to respectable working class people. The sort of people that went to church on a Sunday and, you know, prayed and went to work and did all the things. She was not acceptable. And I think by cutting her own path and not letting her mistakes define her, that made her a very unlikable figure within her community. She'd been a servant girl, she'd been a criminal, a traveler, she'd been a fortune teller, and in my view, now she was a businesswoman. And people didn't like that. When we learn about her trial shortly, one of the things that really stands out is her being referred to as having a very bad character, which, again, I think is so indicative to the views of women who escaped perceived normality at the time. You know, I think probably we'd have been told that we had very bad character if we're
100%.
Yeah.
100%. There's a lot of vagaries with that, because I was just going to ask, because I was going to say, do we think if she'd been a man, she'd become folkloric in the kind of the way, I can't remember that chap's name, I can't remember his name, that kept escaping from prison and everyone's like, oh my God, he's a complete hero. And then they captured him, he escaped again in Georgian London. And yet if that had been a woman, they'd be like, oh, she's in there. You know, like, it's interesting, isn't it? I know. Obviously that dynamics are very apparent, but it's just this idea that is she unsavory almost solely based on her gender, which is really quite probable, isn't it?
Yes. And I think it's interesting because when you look at, as we mentioned in another episode, a lot of Shropshire has a lot of male cunning men, cunning folk. It's almost accepted that a cunning folk should have tomes of the occult, they should be able to read. And even if they can't read, they should have these books as props. That's part of them, you know, part of their shtick kind of thing. But her having books was seen as this wicked, wicked thing. And I think a lot of people were incredibly threatened by her. And I think a lot of people would have not liked the fact that she had not played the victim, that she'd not stayed down, that she'd had cut her own path. I think even in her choice of men, it becomes apparent that she has cut her own path. So we know that she had been married to Thomas, and Thomas passed away in 1856. Within 12 months, Anne Morgan had been killed. She'd been murdered. She'd been stabbed to death in her own home in Westwood Common by someone that she had met, and all evidence really does now point to him being her lover or some form of romantic dynamic. Now, it's interesting because her William Davis, her lover, the man that she had taken in, who had moved in with her quite quickly, was about 30 years her junior. So my girl Anne had got herself a toy boy, not always the Not always the best option given what happened to her.
Clearly not, but yeah.
No. So a lot of people had kind of said, oh, you know, how do we know that? A lot of folklorists have argued that either they weren't, or that she had took him in out of pity because he didn't have a job, or there's lots of different variations. But I have found some evidence to suggest that they were had registered a marriage bans in Italy, so not too far away. And I found that quite interesting because they haven't gone to Wenlock to register the marriage ban. So to me, that's probably either to do with where he is from. Maybe he was from around Madeley. I've not been able to prove that. Or even that they were seen as such an unacceptable relationship that they had to go a bit further afield to kind of make it to happen, because maybe... that the vicar wouldn't have done it or what have you. This is just speculation, but there is some evidence that they registered a marriage bans in Madeley, but never actually got round to getting married. And the relationship wasn't the best. And I do, even though William Davis is described at the time as a weak and silly and offensive fellow, which I wouldn't want the person writing that to write my CV.
yeah, thanks. Do you want to write my eulogy? Sounds great. Yeah. My Tinder profile. I don't need to. I should say that's not. But yeah, I'm not single. But you know, yeah. If, just anyway, that person who wrote that's dead anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, they're gone. I do want to. I do have some sympathy for him because I do believe this is a very complex situation. I believe there is a very complex power dynamic within their relationship. I believe that they both would have cared quite profoundly for each other. But I think that they were profoundly unsuitable for each other. And I think they both would have been in their own way quite abusive to each other.
Yeah.
I think he saw her money as very attractive. I think he saw the fact that she was quite wealthy as being an attractive feature. And I think she tried to control him. And it escalated into the situation that left Anne dead. So I by no means want to talk ill of either people. Obviously, William Davis was a murderer. He did murder Anne Morgan. But I believe that there was a lot more of an abusive situation that, as we'll see in the trial, was portrayed as a magical or occult situation. So Anne, on the 12th of September, was stabbed to death in her home. She had had her face, her neck, her wrists, and her hands stabbed, as well as receiving other wounds. And rather sadly, one of the wounds had cut her carotid artery, so she had died in quite a measurable amount of pain, and there was a lot of blood. So it's a really awful crime scene to think about, and I don't want to dwell too much on the actual scene of the crime because it was awful. And I think sometimes her murder has been underplayed. There's been this idea that it was seen as a just desserts because of her witchcraft.
Yeah.
And I think that completely negates the tragedy of the crime. Mm-hmm. And I think it completely negates the tragedy of later crimes and similar crimes that happen even to this day. If we say that a woman deserved to die because she was a witch, we're saying that we're victim blaming, and I think we really shouldn't do it. And I think because this is a folkloric story, often people rely on tropes or stereotypes and they forget that this was a real woman as well. And rather strangely, there was a man in the 1940s who shared an anecdote from his grandfather, who had lived in Westwood Common at the time. Yeah. And he'd said that on the morning of Anne Morgan's death, she had actually predicted that somebody would die that morning, but she hadn't predicted that it would be herself, which I think is an incredibly powerful kind of idea, even if there's no truth in it. It's the way her story was being told afterwards. Yeah. So Davis had moved in with her about 12 months before the murder. he was between jobs. He was kind of living off her wealth, and she was quite willing to support him. She was quite willing to, you know, do that, despite the fact that he hadn't really made any effort to find any work. There is different conversations about how the murder actually happened. The most kind of the most logical argument, and the one that I've seen repeated probably the most, is that on the morning of her murder, Anne had given him some money to go into Much Wenlock to buy some meat for dinner. And he got very, very drunk on the money and come back without the food. There'd been an argument. That argument had escalated. The argument started in the street and then it escalated and went into the house. And then he snapped and he murdered her. Interestingly, he'd bought the knife prior. I think it was about 3 days prior to the actual event and the actual murder, which does suggest an element of premeditation. But I do feel that very much in that moment, sparks were flying, people were angry, and he acted. And he run away, he left her for dead. If we flash forward to the actual trial now, because I think this is where the second injustice happens to Anne. The first injustice is that she was murdered. The second injustice is the way in which the trial was handled. There became this narrative that Anne had been murdered to escape a magical thraldom, that William Davis had been seduced by this powerful temptress, and the only way he could ever be free from her was to kill her. And there was even an argument that... it's so frustrating. And there is an idea in folklore that if you draw the blood of a witch, you can escape her power. So, and that's a universal kind of folklore. And you do see in the 1800s evidence of trials like actual crimes like this happening, where there is a perceived witch, someone draws blood of her or beats her up or enacts a lot of harm to her. And when it goes to trial, they use the argument of the folklore. Well, we were just trying to escape her. So this, I think there's at least one I can think of. And I think it was kind of Dorset, that kind of way, Somerset kind of way. So they tried to use that with Anne Morgan's trial. They tried to say that William Davis had just been trying to draw blood, or he was trying to escape this magical thraldom. It was much easier for the trial and for the jury and everyone to believe that he had been seduced by a witch than that he could love an older woman. And I think that's a whole different conversation about how society has perceived older women and, you know, the idea that this younger man couldn't possibly have had feelings for this older woman. He did say when the police caught up with him and said, you know, you've killed her, he said, oh, well, I did love that old woman. So there's an element of feeling there.
Yeah.
But the defence, even prominent minds like the mayor of Much Wenlock, Richard Nicholas, they all said that Anne had been murdered because William Davis had tried to escape her magical power. And lots of people went on record actually talking about her being a witch, talking about her, you know, occult powers, and that actually William Davis was not innocent, but he shouldn't be blamed, which, you know, this is 1857. It's 1857, and you've got people using the murder of a woman as justification for this prejudice about witchcraft and that kind of thing. And it's just so shocking to me that all of these centuries of crimes against women, all of these centuries of crimes against witches, and we're in the 1800s and the same narrative is happening again.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. I agree completely.
And it's just, you know, shocking. And I think there is some really quite powerful moments in the trial, and all of this research I've found from the British newspaper archives, and so it's all very accessible. It's something that you can read for yourselves if you are interested. But we're told in the folklore that no one mourned Anne Morgan, no one cared that she died. The only person that mourned her was her dog, who was heard howling after she'd been murdered, which is so sad. But that again is a way to rob her legacy, because when you read the actual trial and you read how it was reported, one of her nephews, a 10-year-old boy called John Rowlands, heard the commotion, he heard the argument, and he actually saw Davis leaving the house covered in blood. And he run home and he told his mother that Billy, who was William Davis, had murdered his aunt. And that people then gathered the neighbours, his mum gathered the neighbours, and they went and found Anne Morgan's body.
Yeah.
This was incredibly hard on the young boy. It was hard on his mum, who was her, she was his aunt. So people did mourn her. People were sad that she'd gone, and people did feel that loss. I think it's interesting as well, because it actually, the trial and the death of Anne Morgan actually has a link to William Penny Brooks, the father of the Olympics, because he was the doctor that actually was the person on the scene that pronounced her dead.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So he was a magistrate. I mean, on other things, he was a magistrate, he was a botanist and educational reformer. And he was on the scene. He was the first person to kind of look, and he was actually at the trial and gave evidence about the injuries and everything. So Anne Morgan is just a small piece of William Penny Brooks's life. He's done amazing things, but he has that link to her.
I'd say, hearing that and with the reform and everything, I'd say the Olympics is the most boring thing about him. I'd be like, sorry, that's a bit controversial. Well, it's not controversial, is it? But
no, he's the reason we have to do PE as well. So I was never a fan.
No, not a massive fan, to be honest. But yeah, I'd say that's the most boring thing about him, is like, you know, there's the 100 meters or something. Like, no, look.
That's
the shot put. Yeah.
He was actually one of the people that caused her autopsy. He did her autopsy as well. So there was two. There was a Mr. James, never found out what his first name was, and William Penny Brooks, who did her autopsy, which is really interesting. You've got that link to a very, very famous figure, not just in Shropshire, but also kind of in Britain. And that's not reported very much at all.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like it should be as well. It's not going to be, is it? Because it's about a woman and all this. Yeah, but I think that is very relevant.
Yeah, I think it's important. And he was actually quite shocked by the trial. We don't get much, because he's a Victorian man and stiff upper lip and all that. But he does refer to the crime as being, you know, appalling, and that it was quite a difficult one for him to do. So it is interesting to consider what he'd have made of it and how it would have stayed with him afterwards. We'll never know. But it's an interesting little aspect of her story. And you know, the newspapers absolutely drag her. They say that she was assumed to exercise supernatural powers, incantations appearing to be the very words of fate, that she had a bad character, and that she was much addicted to abusive language and of passionate temper.
And I bet that they thought she was licentious and all the rest of it, and it's the usual trope, isn't it, surrounding women generally.
Even if she swore a lot and she had a bit of a temper, it's a poor excuse for murder, isn't it? And as I've said, I do believe there was a very abusive dynamic to their relationship. I do believe that there was a drunken element to the event as well. And I do believe that we shouldn't look retrospectively at the crime and say, oh, he was terrible, he was a bad person, because we don't know the dynamic fully and we never will do. But that's also not to say that he was a weak and silly fellow who was driven to murder by witchcraft. He was a man that acted, and he acted in a way that caused a woman to die. That's all we can really say at this point. And he was originally going to be sentenced to death. because it was seen a life for a life. But then that sentence was quickly changed. He was given respite and he was sentenced to penal servitude. He was said to have gone to prison in some versions of the folk story. This is where it gets a bit hazy to track down the actual. We have some newspaper reports of his sentencing, or that he's due to be sentenced, but then it gets a bit folkloric again, because one of the versions of the story says that he was transferred over to Australia, but the ship was sailing to Australia, there was a violent storm and he drowned, which gave Anne her final revenge, which is it's great to think about, isn't it, that she could get her revenge, but there's just not the historic evidence to find that. I've never found a record of him being but it also links to kind of that idea of witches being able to control kind of the weather, can't they? Because it was Anne of Denmark, the King of Scotland's wife, I can't remember which King of Scotland.
James VI, yeah.
Could, you know, those whipping up of violent storms and things. So
all that kind of, yeah, exactly.
They're playing up to those tropes. We don't have much more information about William, but what we do know is that Anne was not given any dignity in death, which again is incredibly sad. There's an idea in the folklore that people were worried about her corpse, the idea that her corpse would be a prime catalyst to bring back a spirit into the world and have a ghost on her hands, as we talked about in a couple of episodes ago. So she was actually buried as she was found, still in her bloodstained clothes. I don't know why it always gets to me. I think it's just the how impersonal it is, but she was actually still missing a shoe when she buried her. They buried her.
I think that's cruel more than it. Yeah.
And it does. It just feels so casting her away. Just right. Let's chuck her body in a hole and be done with it, rather than giving her a shred of dignity in death. I have spent a long time trying to find out where she was actually buried. And
okay,
it's interesting because folklore said that she was buried in an unmarked grave in Boughton Cemetery, which made sense. But I looked elsewhere and I looked and went down all these different tangents and all that kind of thing. But actually, this is one of those instances where folklore is actually telling the truth, because I found a record for her being buried on the 17th of September, 1857, in Boughton Cemetery. And she's known by, she's actually recorded on the burial record as all of the names she went by in life. So you've got Morgan, you've got Williams, which was her maiden name, and then you've also got Evans, which I've never been able to find out who the Evans was and why she went by Evans, but I love it. I love the fact she did. So
Shropshire Evans, there's a lot of,
It is, it's, and it was really powerful when I found the record to see her name and then that simple word, murdered. And I think it was after about 2 years of looking into her and trying to rehumanize her and show that she was a woman and that she was a person and she wasn't this stock Halloween character. And that just word, murdered, it reduced me to tears. I've got to say, it made me very...
It's awful. It's really, really sad.
And I think the saddest thing about Anne is that she wasn't a victim for so much of her life. She rose up and she showed up and she dealt with whatever life threw at her.
Yeah.
But she was made a victim, not only by her fate as being murdered, but by the way that the community treated her. Yeah. And the folklore suggests that they took all of her belongings down to a pub called the Falcon's Yard Inn, and they burnt them.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I shouldn't swear, but yeah.
Yeah, it's the reaction. It's the idea that you can't have any aspect of this woman still here. I've never been able to 100% verify that that happened. But even if it's only got a grain of truth, the idea that you can not only wipe this woman out of existence, she's in an unmarked grave, You're burning all of her things. You're taking away that person. And it feels ritualistic. It's we must cleanse.
I think it is that. I think exactly that is exactly what it is. Yeah.
And it's so sad to think that she has been reduced to the wicked spirit that stands on the streets and seduces young men, rather than actually this woman that was made of multitudes, because that's what she was. She was so fascinating and interesting, and she wasn't perfect, you know, by God. You know, she'd been a criminal, she'd been really quite, you know, she was known for an abusive tongue in her previous marriage with her husband, so she would have been a very strong, very at times probably quite aggressive woman, but everything she was for her to endure and for her to continue. And I think when we look at witches, we often at times I think fall upon some of the tropes. You've either got the evil witch in the cottage over by the, you know, the edge of the forest, or you've got the sexy seductress who is doing glam magic.
The sex appeal and the, yeah.
Yeah. And I think probably one of the things I want to convey most about the story of Anne Morgan is that she was a woman. She would have had hopes and she would have had dreams. There'd have been times where she laughed. There'd have been times where she cried. She was a person, and she was exactly the same as us.
Yeah.
I think by demonizing her and demonizing women like her, we're actually saying that things like that can continue. I think, you know, I think her legacy needs to be turned into a bit of a war cry. I think she needs to be seen as someone who endured despite everything that life threw at her. And even now, you know, it's over 100 years since this crime happened, and one cannot help but still be moved by the crime. But also we're sat here talking about her because she has endured. We need to turn the tides against these narratives of these wicked witches seducing men on the common, and instead think about who they could be as people.
Yeah.
And I think this is where Anne's story becomes symbolic in another way, because she doesn't only symbolize the women who have been wronged, or the women that have been murdered, or the women who have been misunderstood by history. She's also standing alongside all of the forgotten women, the women who still lived and loved and felt, but have been forgotten by history. So I really do believe that her story is far more complex than it's ever been led to believe prior. And I'm not saying that I've done anything particularly special with it, but I've just took the time to actually listen and to challenge that narrative of her being this. I mean, and you know, if she was a sexy lady that could still seduce men in her 60s, then fair play to her, she deserves that recognition. But that shouldn't be the only thing she's remembered for.
I totally agree. And the thing is, I think you have done something special, because I think the thing is, it's like, you know, these, I think what is so tragic about this is that you've got an intelligent woman who made her own path. If she'd been a man, just by the way, probably also would she not have been murdered and treated like she was. But I think this idea of an intelligent woman forming her own path and things like this, of course, like they've done with Anne Boleyn, with other women, they're like, oh, she must have loved it, or she must have been like this, or, you know, you have to be one thing, like she's the sexy siren, the kind of the tempted this man and did this. And you're like, hey, how about this trope? How about she was intelligent? Do you know what? She was attractive. Fine. Great. Good for her. But also maybe her and that younger man, maybe it was a dynamic that worked for a while. Okay. Maybe she thought, you know what? Maybe he loves me, maybe he doesn't, but she was having a good time. And they argued and things like this. But I think it's so tiresome, this idea, and how they have to obliterate women from the face of the earth in a way that I feel they don't do with men. Like Henry VIII getting rid of the H's and the A's and things, missed a few at Hampton Court, we know this, but, you know, no preparation was made, just stuck in an arrow chest, all these things that you're like, these women were killed and they're like, gone, be gone, I'm going down the Thames to marry Jane Seymour. And you're like, just F off, frankly. this idea that they have to obliterate women. And it's a trope, the same as like you still hear today. Like if somebody, you know, the other day I did my eyeliner. This is just a roundabout, but someone, I won't say who, but someone in the situation was like, oh, you look happy with yourself. And I was like, do you know what? First of all, I just thought my eyeliner looked nice. And secondly, I was like, do you know what? And so what if I am? Because if a man comes in and looks nice or smells nice, whatever, and has confidence, we're like, who's that? But if a woman's like, my eyeliner looks nice, we're like, she's a bit smug. And you're like, no. So it's so in every little tiny pocket of society, going right up to women like this who are intelligent, making their own path, being completely decimated from society. So although a silly story about eyeliner sounds obsolete, it's not, because it's in every little pocket of things that we do. We're constantly observed for like, are we past 35? Maybe we're a bit knackered. Things like this. Maybe we need this and this to preserve and stop time. No, we don't. I mean, Mary Beard tweeted something the other day and I thought, amazing. Why do women feel they have to freeze time to be on television in a way that a lot of men don't? It's bollocks.
Yeah.
But it's a narrative that we are all still adhering to. And Anne Morgan has been dead a very long time and was treated abysmally. And we are still really no further along in many ways. I mean, we can vote, but what else? Like, there's still pay difference. I mean, it's shocking, this idea of day-to-day life, of how women are treated, the difference between men and women, that the narratives are still relevant today, I'd argue, as much as they've ever been.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think that's why she's so powerful, is because she's an extreme case, because it was a woman who was murdered. But that's not far removed from experiences that still happen today. You know, when something terrible happens to a woman, I still think there is an element in certain spheres of society that ask what she did to deserve it. And that's not everyone, but I still think there is that element. And I think that's why she is so symbolic, not only of the women that have come before us, but also the women that we stand aside now. And I think her story is so important, and that she shouldn't be seen just as what, you know, I love folklore, and I have spent a lot of my life actually studying it and sharing it, but she was more than what folklore allowed her to be. And I do think, yes, she might have been abusive and liked swearing a lot, and she might have been a bit of a cow at times, but I also think that she was remarkable.
Yeah, I think that's it. And I think it's interesting. I think you articulate that so well, because she might not be a perfect victim in terms of, but then who is? Because what do we feel, you know, even in tropes, when you watch things about the Tudors, it's always the femme fatale, or the dangerous woman always has dark hair, you know, a blonde woman represents it. Like, what is this trope? You know, and this idea of these women, you know, she wasn't a perfect victim, because who is? But it's the same when you hear these poor girls that get attacked and things like that. And, you know, they're like, well, what was she doing in the park at that time? You know, probably thinking that someone wasn't going to attack her and kill her. I don't know. Maybe we should just stop people attacking women. I mean, I know obviously it happens to men as well, but I would say, you know, with women, there was like, what was she wearing? Why was she there? Does it matter? Is it relevant? No, it's not relevant. You should be able to walk along the river and not get attacked. But I think this idea, you know, and even things going into certain situations, I know there's lots of people who aren't ideal, but even things like Meghan Markle, you know, I don't know anything about her. I don't know her. I'm sure she's as, you know, as probably as bad as most of the royals. But I think it's still this idea that they just absolutely bash her for every single thing.
Yes.
You know, and I find it extraordinary. They're like, she did this, she bewitched Harry. No, maybe he just loves his wife. You know, I'm not interested in either of them, but how about that, for example? Maybe it's just a man that loves his wife. How about that crazy notion? You know, I don't know enough about either of them, but I just think this idea that there's always a femme fatale, and there's always a woman that's, you know, whatever it may be, looks like this, looks too old, looks too whatever. And then if somebody makes too much effort, they've tried too hard. If they don't make enough, they're a bag lady. You know, you're like, come on, girls can't win.
No,
and then before you know it, you're too old. And, you know, you're like, yeah, but men aren't. There's men on TV that are in their 60s and 70s, and everyone's like, oh, aging like a fine wine. Women are just past it.
Yes.
Yeah. An exhausted trope, and you're like, really? I mean, ultimately, I suppose it's one that we can't change for a long time, but she's an absolute pinup of somebody that is not an ideal victim. But I mean, she's a victim of a crime, but in her life, is she a victim? No, I think she's a really sturdy, robust woman who actually, despite being treated probably even back to being a child pretty abysmally, made her way. And also, I think, you know, when we look at kings in medieval times and things, they're brutal, but you know, they're men and they were brutal because it was a battle of power and things. But a woman like Anne Boleyn being a product of her time or being seen as modern is then become sexual. So why can't a woman be intelligent and of her time and seeing a path in the way that men can't? You know, oh yes, because she's a woman.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's remarkable. Problem. It is. It really is. And I think, I always think when they talk about, oh, she was this awful, wicked woman and she was terrible. Well, if she was so wicked, why are you buying potions from her? Why are you buying things from her? Why are you doing anything to do with her? Just leave her alone. Just ignore her. Just don't speak to her or have anything really to do with her. You know,
you're exactly right. And do you think this is interesting? You know, when I was thinking, funny enough, when you were talking about it, I was thinking people like the Suffolk Strangling. Do you remember these sex workers that were killed? And they were so condemned. And I was thinking, well, first of all, we know nothing about their story, but also it's like Hallie Reubenhold talking about Jack the Ripper's victims, where actually I think only one of them was actually established to be a sex worker.
Yeah.
But it was assumption. And also these things, the same as escorts, whatever it may be, there are strip clubs, whatever they may be, that people frequent and pay money for services. It's an transaction, sorry. And then the women are blamed. And you're like, what about the people that are parting with their money for this service and then going back to their lives, like Mrs. Beaton, who is possibly the most wholesome image, but arguably possibly had syphilis because her husband was a prolific womanizer. But, you know, it's these examples of like these women that are ostracized or othered from society, and witches are the same. And you know, I find this whenever I try to Google a certain picture for a post about us talking about the podcast, whatever it may be, you know, you put in witches, medieval witch, whatever it be. And do you know how, and I know you must do the same, do you know how far I have to scroll down just to get past the sexualized anime kind of like massive boobs, witches? Kind of, I'm like, oh, then I'm going like this, going, yeah, yeah, great. You look gorgeous, girls. You're not real, but fine. You know, find one that maybe is like Goya's Witches Sabbath or something. But it's these hyper sexualized, even when you look at programs, and I keep mentioning Anne Boleyn because she's a good example, but again, somebody like this, these hyper sexualized images of these costumes that are so inaccurate, kind of going, this is what they look like. You're like, is it? Is it? Because I feel like it probably isn't. And I feel like she's another one that her sexuality seems so relevant, but also because I suppose maybe because she was in the Victorian society, who were the most sexually kind of obsessed of arguably anyone with things like gentleman's relish. And I thought it was interesting when, because I was listening, and when you said about the idea of these kind of Christian people, which I completely get as like a tongue-in-cheek thing, was most of them were probably cheating on their spouse. Most of them were in unhappy marriages. Most of them were probably doing very un-Christian. I mean, whatever Christian things may be, you know, some of the most abhorrent things have been done in the name of the church. But, you know, these are probably people with an enormous collection of gentlemen's relish. These are also probably people that absolutely, like you say, were paying for her services, but were, you know, she was considered smutty. So in public, they were like, no. And you're like, is this like the guys that slide into people's DMs? And then they're like, oh yeah, she's a slag. And you're like, yeah, but mate, weren't you just like sliding into someone's DMs? Aren't you the problem here?
Yeah. Like, she's the witch. Yeah, but why are you buying from her if she's
that bad? And you're like, maybe, you know. And also, like, she's making quite a decent living out of something that actually clearly there's a calling for. But because of it, at its time, it was kind of considered smutty. They're like,
she would have almost been a millionaire by today's standards. She wasn't far off.
Good for her.
And she was very good at it. She was known to have a curse so potent that it could cut into the very heart of the person and destroy them from the inside out, which is, you know, total nonsense. She probably would have just said some things and then it would have made people paranoid. But she must have been a good actress to be able to do that. And I do, I think, isn't it? Yeah, I think there's so much we can learn from her story in a number of ways, but we can learn about how women are perceived. I think particularly older women, particularly women who are on the margins, women who are in abject poverty, women who succeed despite poverty as well.
I totally agree. And I think it's the idea of anything kind of, maybe it used to be kind of post-menopause, but I'm going to say, look, I'm 37 and I think it's kind of anything sort of post-35, people are like, you're getting on a bit. And you're like, are you serious? And all I find really interesting is it's always blokes in their 40s who kind of, for whatever situation, like I have the same with all my running and stuff. And it's always some bloke who probably hasn't run for 15 years. It's like, what you want to do with your running is this. You're like, how about you don't mansplain, particularly about something you don't do yourself? Or maybe you take a long look in the mirror, babe. You know, and I think there must be like female historians and things. And I think with your work, which is extensive and impressive and thorough, you must encounter, I know obviously, you know, you're far too kind of decent to ever say, but you must encounter regular mansplaining from people. And you're like, and we've discussed this personally as well, as we know that sometimes you'll put up a post and someone has to make an observation about whether someone's hot or not or something else. And you're like, oh, yeah. I'm so glad that feels so relevant right now.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, come on.
I did have one, somebody tell me I was, because I like posting little bits of folklore and I posted a little snippet of folklore and somebody told me I was wrong and then linked me to my own blog. And I did have a moment where I was like, no, that's me.
I have a better story than that. Yeah.
And I was like, they were like, no, it's not. It's nearly knowledgeable. You're Goblin Egg. And I was like, no, I'm Amy. And that was me who wrote that.
You said nearly knowledgeable. Yeah. God.
Yeah. So that's my biggest claim to fame, I think, with mansplaining, is that somebody mansplained me using myself.
Like, guys, you mansplainers, you're the best, huh? You're so thorough.
You've really done your research there, but thank you for reading my blog.
Thank you for visiting my blog. Appreciate it. Thank you.
I need the views.
God, I think it's, you know, and I feel unfair because there's lots of men that kind of absolutely sound that you're like,
definitely.
And also, I think that there's lots of women that would have followed the same narrative of kind of, because, you know, again, like Meghan Markle, women love to bash, like, if she looked awful in this dress, you're like, did she look awful? Because I can tell you, I've looked way worse than that. And I'm thinking, if Meghan Markle looked awful, there's no chance for the rest of us. Do you know what I mean? But I think it's, you know, it does, a lot of it does come from patriarchal society, but I think there's a lot of bashing that come from women. And I don't doubt that Anne in her time, there would have been a lot of women that maybe felt so threatened by her. Or that kind of, you know, that exhausted thing of like, she's probably after my husband. And you're like, have you seen your husband?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, I think she would have got a lot of criticism from women, I believe. I believe there would have been a lot of her. Like, you'd only have to look at how Charlotte Byrne talks. Again, I feel like I'm bashing Charlotte Byrne. I love it a bit. But the way she sort of talks about certain groups of people, there would have been women who might have gone and bought a love potion from her or had their fortune read, but then be stood at market day talking about how much of a horrible fallen woman she was. And I think that's what the power of the patriarchy is, that it turns everyone against women, even women.
I agree. It's a really good point. And I think, and interesting enough, because of your influence, I was reading something of Charlotte Byrne the other day, and I was going to send you a picture, and I will do, I'm trying to remember it verbatim and I can't, but there is a bit like only about two pages in where she's kind of telling this story and she's like, you know, they're working class, you have to take it with a pinch of salt, but she doesn't say it like that, but it's basically to that effect. And I was like, all right, Charlotte, like casting shade two pages in, but she says it like really earnestly and you're going, okay, I see this, like, it's a bit like reading Frances Hodgson where you kind of go, not quite sure that's PC, but, you know, it's a lovely story. So let's just go through that and maybe not read that aloud. But I think Charlotte does the same. I'm reading it going, of her time, of her time.
Yes, remember that.
You're like, she is judgy. But I also, you know, you kind of like her, but you're like, oh, Charlotte, you're a little bit.
Yeah, I wouldn't tell her I'm from the East Shropshire coalfield. I wouldn't say, oh, by the way, I'm from Telford. Well, Telford didn't exist then, but I wouldn't go, yeah, so I'm from Madeley Wood. She'd probably just walk away.
She'd be angry, yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like when she was around, definitely my family were kind of lead miners from Shropshire, so she'd also have been like, I think, yeah. She'd, you know, those ones up in Snell Beach that are clearly all kind of, you know, whatever, marrying their cousins and things. I mean, she's probably not wrong in some cases, but, you know, certainly in my family, probably at some point. But it was a little village. It was a small chapel. But yeah, no, I'm joking. I'm half joking. God knows. Who knows? It's a long time ago. But look, I really enjoyed this. Is it, if you were going to give us kind of anything that was a sort of last thought on Anne Morgan and why she should firstly not only become merch, because she will in time, we will do that, but a kind of lasting thought of why people should look into her more, or why we should reconsider her story. I'm putting a bit of pressure on you here, but what would your kind of final thought on Anne be?
I think it would be the idea that she endured. I think it'd be the idea that regardless of what life threw at her, she was able to navigate it and she was able to succeed. She was able to become her own person and in many ways free herself from some of the pressures of the patriarchy, but then ultimately fell victim to the patriarchy. And I think when looking at her story, we should look at her for all of her multitudes rather than just one narrative or one aspect of the narrative. We should accept that she was a woman with many, many facets.
Mm. I think that's brilliant. I think that's fantastic. And I think as soon as you said that she's on the records, I was like, yeah, I'm going to look, because British newspaper archives, census, things like that. And I'm, you know, we're both very active, and Amy is particularly good at Twitter or X or whatever you call it these days. But I think we can probably do a post sort of explaining where it's best to research cases like this. And Amy is really good at this. So for anybody interested in that type of thing, we'll try and put some posts up. We've got our next episode, our main episode in terms of Outside of Extra Contact, coming at the end of the week, which is going to be on. Amy, you can describe what it's going to be.
We are going to be looking at the folklore of the sea and folklore of water, which you wouldn't think was linked to Shropshire, but actually has a lot of links. So we're going to look at all the wonderful stuff regarding the sea and water-based spirits and folklore, as well as delving into some Shropshire stories.
I'm very excited. I've given any kind of, even though you sort of hinted what you're going to talk about, I've given it all a wide berth so I can be surprised on the podcast, because I like sort of hearing all these things that I've never heard anything about. I'm really excited. So it's going to be great. And I hope that all of you have enjoyed this, who listen to this. We're going to try and create a few sort of more bits of extra content and things. And also, if there's anything that anybody would like us to talk about, you can find us on our socials as well. So look us up at the Shropshire Witches and Shropshire Witches Pod, etc. You can find us, and Nearly Knowledgeable for Amy, and I'm Alix, A-L-I-X. See you. So send us your ideas and things, and we'll see you all very soon.